Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Hunting John List. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. The difference, particularly in terms of classification, between a mass murderer and a serial killer, is the timing of the killings and the presence of what's known as a, quote, cooling off period. Mass murderers typically will kill four or more people at one single time and in one location, while serial killers murder multiple people over an extended period with cooling off intervals in between. There are, of course, psychological differences between the two, but I'm not going to dig into those for the purpose of this episode. A mass murderer will kill all of their victims in a single and likely explosive event. This event is likely motivated by revenge, retaliation, or rage, and often suicidal. The end goal for a mass murder event will frequently aim for maximum impact or media attention, such as with a school shooter or a person committing familicide. Whereas, in contrast to a serial killer who will commit multiple murders separated by days, months, or even years, serial murders will often span multiple locations and are often driven by a psychological thrill, power, or release of sexual pleasure. A serial killer carefully plans their murders. They will seek to avoid detection and often preys on specific types of victims. To the world at large, John Emile List seemed like an average, mild-mannered husband and father, a family man, if you will. He was not a psychopath, he was not a sociopath, and he was not a man without a conscience. You could be sitting next to this man, a man who you would never ever conceive would do something like he did. And you would just assume that he was a happy and friendly everyday Joe. But behind the walls of the List family's New Jersey mansion, things were far different than they appeared to be on the surface. In tonight's episode, we'll take you inside one of the biggest manhunts in United States history, and talk about how police spent decades trying to track down the man responsible for the massacre of his own family. Let's get into it. It's August 30th, 1972. And firefighters are battling a massive house fire in Westfield, New Jersey. As it transpires, it's an historic mansion, and it's burning to the ground. The mansion is named Breeze Knoll. It's a 19-room, Georgian-style house, which had 7 bedrooms, a beautiful foyer with an oak-winding grand staircase. It was literally a Westfield landmark. Built in 1896 by John Witke, a German immigrant and wealthy industrialist, Breeze Knoll was more than a mere residence. It symbolized affluence and elegance within the community. It was both a familial haven and social hub, reflecting Witke's prominent status in the town. The mansion's white exterior, adorned with dark green shutters and a classic Palladian window, provided a dramatic visual symmetry admired by the entire town. The house's interior boasted oak flooring. 10 fireplaces decorated the rooms of the mansion, constructed from marble and hand-carved teak. The house also included a multitude of living spaces, including 2 living rooms, a stately dining room, large kitchen, butler's pantry, laundry room, a Tiffany glass skylight, and a grand ornate ballroom. But on this summer night, it all made for expensive firewood. 9 months earlier, Breeze Knoll was the location of one of America's worst mass killings to date. A mother, a grandmother, and 3 children were each shot to death point blank. The cold-blooded slaughter of an entire family, carefully calculated and planned. To this very day, the Westfield locals who we have spoken to have likened the incident to when JFK got shot, or when the space shuttle Challenger exploded. It was a pivotal and darkly iconic moment in the history of their historic town. You see, Westfield has long been one of New Jersey's most affluent communities, idyllic in a lot of ways. People wanted to live there. It was a great place to raise a family. And in the early 1970s, Westfield is the home to the List family. John Sr., Helen, and their three children, 16-year-old Patricia, 15-year-old John Jr., and 14-year-old Frederick. John Sr. was an accountant and vice president at a local bank. His wife Helen was an alcoholic homemaker, but she hid it well. In 1965, John moved his family, along with his mother, into 431 Hillside Avenue in Westfield, Breeze Knoll.
I mean, I remember it well, and I remember John and Mr. List really well, and I remember playing at their house really well, because it was just a weird spot.
Charlie Jones here was an old friend of John Jr. and Frederick. You see, when Breeze Knoll comes up for sale, John Sr. jumps at the chance to own it. To John and Helen, the house was a status symbol, a mansion on the hill that overlooked this beautiful town. Indeed, the Lists look the picture of an affluent suburban family. As soon as John Sr. moved to Westfield, he started running the local Sunday school and getting involved in the local community. The Lists put on their smiles and their nice clothes for church, but behind closed doors, the reality was very different. Dave and Brian Devlin lived opposite the Lists.
The DeVoe family lived across the street, and they had seven children. And my family had seven children. You know, back in those days, each neighbor was kind of a treasure. It was a pleasure to have neighbors, because we'd want to have baseball games and stuff in the front yard.
Brian's brother Dave doesn't remember things in the same way.
So my dad and I went down and got an apple pie at Geiger's to welcome the Lists of the neighborhood. So we walked over there and we knocked on their door. You know, they kind of peered out, you know, he was a little surprised that somebody was knocking at the door. And my dad was talking to John List, and he's, you know, and here's an apple pie. And my dad proceeded to tell him about the neighborhood and who everybody is around us. And then he kind of got cut off by John List. And John List said, you know, thank you very much, but we like to keep to ourselves over here. So that was like a first kind of weird indication of what he was all about, you know? So we left, and my dad kind of shook his head, and we were able to say, oh, well, whatever. And, you know, and we had spent so much time in that house and in that yard. And by the way, what a magnificent house it was. I remember a big giant stairway, you know, like Tara, you know, and that came down. And then it went up into a balcony that fed to all the big rooms, you know, and it was truly magnificent. I mean, the Youngs didn't have a lot of money to dress it up, and obviously neither did John. But the big thing was the ballroom, which was it was almost as big as like a basketball court.
Whilst the Lists had lived in the house for around 6 years by the early 1970s, they were now selling furniture to raise money to pay bills. They were struggling financially. John Sr. had large expenses for this large house, which he couldn't pay, and he was falling deeper and deeper into debt. He wanted to appear better than he really was, more affluent, like a big player in the wealthy community. But inside of the house, things were sparse. He couldn't afford it, and the house was falling into disrepair. There's a reason the Lists are having financial problems. For all of his qualifications, it seems John List couldn't hold a job for very long. Sure, he was a fine accountant. The numbers were clear and made sense to him. But he wasn't really good with people. He was just so unlikable, his colleagues commented. By today's standards, it's speculated that John Sr. may have been on the autism spectrum. Here's Dave again.
he was kind of a jerk, though, and he'd peer through the door and go, "What do you want?" And it was almost like he wouldn't let you in the house, and he certainly wouldn't let the kids be exposed to you know, other people.
Now, as I stated, John's mother, Alma, lives with the family. This wasn't because John was particularly close to her. It was more that he needed her. He needed her as his financial woes dragged on, and John ends up draining her life savings to make ends meet. All she had left by the time of her death was $2,000 in savings bonds. In John's very strict Lutheran interpretation of Christianity, if you are impoverished and you don't pay your debts, then it's a quick way to go to hell. Now, in addition to this, the List marriage is also not what it seems to be. To say John List's views are somewhat outdated would be an understatement, even for the 1970s. You see, John believed that the father was the man of the house and should provide for the family while his wife obeys. The children should be good little kids, seen and not heard, and go to church. But in reality, the List's marriage is nothing like that. Helen List is fiercely outspoken, and she suffers from mental illness. She has syphilis, which she contracted from her first husband, Marvin, which she also keeps a secret from John and everyone else. She would regularly comment that if John were half the man that her first husband was, then none of the family's financial issues would be happening. Strangely, Helen kept a photograph of her first husband, Marvin, next to her bed. Helen was particularly hard on John, and it is especially interesting that he seemed to just put up with it. John was a doormat, but obsessed with image. So much so that his neighbours commented and would laugh at the fact that John would mow the lawn wearing a full suit and tie. He wasn't the kind of guy you can knock on the door and have a beer with, other neighbours commented.
Because I was just a little kid trying to find somebody to play with, you know, and she was as nice as could be. And she came down, she was in a nightgown, she came down because apparently she was bedridden, but she was like the sweetest woman to me.
But in 1971, John loses his job, although he doesn't tell anyone, not even his family. He thinks this is a good idea. He engaged in an elaborate charade. Each day, John would go to the train station in his suit, tie, and briefcase, acting the part of a successful Jersey City banker, which he once was. Each day he would sit at the station for 8 hours, reading books that he brought with him, then go home. It was an attempt to convince other people that he was doing well. It was almost as though he couldn't admit it to himself that he was failing. He did not share these truths with anybody, not even his minister. Now, in 1971, John also clashes with his 16-year-old daughter, Patricia. They don't see eye to eye on almost anything. His boys, Fred and John Jr., are described as shy and awkward, more like him. But Patricia could not be more different. She takes after her mother. She was very proud, very self-assured and beautiful. Friends would comment that she was beyond her years. At 16, she had more confidence and more pride than her contemporaries. She was said to be kind of haughty. She would toss her hair, knowing that she was beautiful. She was so self-assured. Patricia was also very active in local community theatre. It's while taking part in this that she meets another young actor named Barry Cohen. Barry says that John List is really not comfortable with the idea of his daughter being on stage. He hates the idea of her performing. As he says it, acting the fool. Susan Cousins was a high school friend of Patricia, and she observed her relationship with her father.
I'd use the word resignation, that she was realizing at some point that she was kind of choosing her life over what John wanted for her. And I think there was a little bit of sadness, if I'm being honest, that I think she realized that she was coming across as disappointing to him. But there was also, again, that self-confidence that said, you know, Dad, I love you, but you gotta let me find my own way here.
John didn't approve of Patricia being in the theater group. He didn't approve of the friends that she hung out with. He was afraid of what influences she might have had in his Christian fundamental way of thinking. In his view, Patricia, being an actress, is like two steps behind being a prostitute. But Patricia is also a teenager, and like all teens, she sometimes pushes boundaries. One night, her and her friend Rhonda Hansen are picked up by the police for smoking cigarettes. To John List, this is a crisis. Rhonda Hansen commented in 2022, quote, "We were at the police station and our fathers had to come pick us up. Patricia's father was furious. He started yelling at Patricia, and then he came up to me angrily and shouted to me, 'You're a bitch as well as a witch.' I thought my dad was going to punch him." You see, sometimes Patricia is portrayed as a rebel, but she was just a normal teenager, pushing back against her strict father's old-fashioned rules. But the relationship between Patricia and her father deteriorated even more. Patricia's friends say she started to make disturbing comments to them. She started practicing witchcraft and told her friend Ed Saradaki that her father had asked his kids about their last will and testament and how they would want to be treated after their deaths.
Would they want to be cremated? Would they want to be buried? Would they want to have a big obituary? Kind of weird stuff for a father to be asking his teenagers. But Patty related to me, and she goes, "What is that? How does that, you know, how does that make you feel?" It. I said, "I don't know, weird." I said, "You know, but you know, your dad's an accountant. You know, he's worried about the numbers, and so you know, he's trying to plan for the future and trying to just brush it off."
In addition to this, less than a month before her death, Patricia was discussing her witchcraft fascination with her friend Susan. Patricia mentioned that she had been talking to the spirits, and they had communicated to her a strange feeling.
Pat said, "You know, I have a feeling within me that, you know, something bad is going to happen." She didn't mention her father. She didn't mention John or Fred. She just said, "I just have a feeling, you know, that something bad, you know, is going to happen. Is there something that I should have seen and didn't? Is there something that I could have done and didn't?" And, you know, with just that one ominous comment made by Patty within a month of her death, it just, I mean, I told my mom about it, but you just say, "Oh, okay." So that's kind of strange. I mean, nothing that you could act on.
In November of 1971, the List family supposedly leaves town. John tells neighbors that they go into North Carolina to take care of a sick relative. But then weeks pass, with no word or sight of the family. Then a month later, on the 7th of December 1971, Westfield Town Police received a call from neighbors. They were concerned for the welfare of the List family. According to the police report, the lights at Breeze Knoll had been left on all day and night for the last month with no sign of anyone being at home. What neighbors noticed over the course of the weeks is there was no activity at the house during the day or night, but lights started to fail, bulbs started burning out. The neighbors were starting to be concerned that maybe John List's mother was still in there, in the house. Additionally, Patricia List's drama teacher kept visiting the house because he also was worried and a little suspicious. Officers were dispatched to the home and checked around the exterior of the house, but found nothing as being particularly out of place or strange. There were no newspapers piled at the front door, no signs of unusual activity, and no broken windows or forced locks. When the police checked with a local high school inquiring about Patricia, Fred, and John Jr., the school told the police that the List family were on an extended vacation and had informed them prior to their departure. That didn't seem out of the ordinary to officers. Since nothing was found at the house, the police left, assuming that lights were left on inside as a security precaution while the family were away. Again, not an uncommon measure. However, the authorities would be called back to the house later that same night. This time, the caller was Patricia's drama teacher. His suspicions had finally reached fever pitch. In speaking to the police, at length, he convinced them that something was most definitely wrong. So the police again visited the List home, but this time they entered through an unlocked window into the basement of the house. The police are also accompanied by a young assistant prosecutor named Michael Mitzner. Mitzner later stated, quote, "The most telling thing about what we were faced with was the odor. The overpowering smell of death." Additionally, there was music playing throughout the house that was described as, quote, "funeral music, a creepy sort of church music." The authorities go in with their flashlights shining. They begin a search of the large house. There were dark streaks across the hallway floor leading towards the ballroom. They followed the streaks. And upon entering the grand and ornate ballroom, they were greeted by four forms laid out on the floor and an unmistakable smell. After closer inspection, the police discover that the four forms were the bodies of Helen List and her three teenage children, all wrapped up in sleeping bags. The bodies were laid out in a row, the children all lined up, and then their mother placed at their feet. The police also located the body of Alma List, the children's grandmother, upstairs in her second floor apartment. All four had been shot in the head, point blank range. It would become apparent very quickly that there was one member of the List family who was not present, however. The patriarch of the family, John List Sr. Strangely, all photographs of John Sr. were also missing from the house. Police launched a manhunt for List right away. Although the authorities had a lot of ground to make up for after they quickly established that John Sr. had more than a month's head start on them. John had been entirely thorough with the murders. He had shot his wife, mother, and three children, one at a time, before moving all but his mother into the ballroom. After doing so, he cancelled his newspapers, mail, and milk deliveries, so deliveries wouldn't build up outside the home, drawing unwanted attention to it. John also prepared and mailed letters to his children's high school and to his wife's part-time job, telling them that the family was going on an extended holiday and that they wouldn't be back for a few weeks. List cleaned up the crime scene and removed all of his pictures from around the house. John figured that by doing this, the police would have no good references to use when they started their search for him. John then drove to JFK Airport and subsequently vanished. Law enforcement were utterly flummoxed. They knew that List went to JFK Airport, as police found his car abandoned in the airport car park around 3 weeks later. But there was no evidence that he ever boarded a flight there, nor was his body ever found. The murders quickly captured national attention across the United States and Canada, yet no signs of List had been reported. At the crime scene, police reconstructed what happened on the day of the murder. It was the meticulousness of John List's crime that even veteran investigators said they'd never seen before. Former Westfield Police Chief Barney Tracy communicated it best when he said, quote, "List was that kind of man, though. An accountant. List planned it. He did everything in an exact manner. The ledger was balanced. For him, as an accountant, everything was carried out meticulously." The killing spree started early in the morning after his children had gone to school. His wife Helen came downstairs to the kitchen and prepares herself some toast and coffee and sits at the dining table. John retrieves his two guns, a 9mm Steyr handgun and a Colt 22 caliber revolver, and shoots her once in the back of the head. List drags his wife's body into the ballroom, and then he goes upstairs, where he murders his mother. And then, incredibly, police say he makes himself a sandwich. John then waits till each child is home from school, and one by one, he executes them at gunpoint. Years later, John Sr. would write his memoirs. This is all he had to say about murdering his wife. Quote,
I took a deep breath, walked into the kitchen with my hand on the cold grip of the stire, moved up behind my wife, pulled the pistol out and fired into the back of her head for instant effect. I stepped back as her diseased, ravaged, and now dead body slid silently, sort of in slow motion, to the floor.
For clarity, we use an actor to voice John List here, but these are his actual recorded words. Now that his wife and mother were dead, and John had eaten his sandwich, he waited. Patricia signed herself out of school at noon. She said that she had cramps. Then she headed to Duke's sub shop downtown. An employee stated that she was friendly, and also told police that she was there until about 12:30, and then he overheard someone say to her that her father was outside and was there to pick her up. And that was the last that anyone ever saw of Patricia List. John List drove her home. He parked the car, and they both walk into the house together. As they walk into the laundry room next to the kitchen, John fires a single shot into the left side of Patricia's face, killing her instantly. John painstakingly starts mopping the blood from the kitchen floor.
I had to mop the floor 3 or 4 times, and because we had no mop wringer, I had to wring accumulated blood out of the mop by hand. Gruesome work.
Following this, John then popped out to collect the dry cleaning, and he also did a few other errands before coming back home. John's next victim is Fred. He's just 14 years old, 5'5", and weighs around 125 pounds. Fred was at his after-school job at KMV Associates, where he and Patricia both worked part-time after school. Fred called his dad that afternoon to pick him up, and shortly after, he headed out to jump in his dad's car. Back at home, Fred and his father walked into the back door by the kitchen. John, once again, points the gun at the left side of his son's face and shoots him once, killing him immediately. There is a calm matter-of-factness about it all. The last to die is the middle child, John Jr. Unlike the others, John Sr. shoots him 10 times. He put multiple gunshots into that boy's head. It was just horrific. There's been speculation that maybe the child fought back. He was 5'11" and 170 pounds. So maybe he resisted. This is only speculation, though, in an attempt to understand the excessive amount of bullet wounds compared to the rest of the family. In his memoir and confession letter, John List claims to have shot everyone from behind so they didn't know what was coming. But as the autopsy reports confirm, this isn't true for all of his victims. After murdering his family, detectives say, List spends one more night in the mansion with the bodies of his family, and then the next morning, he makes his getaway. He seems really unbothered about what he's doing. He knew he needed a good night's sleep before he escaped across the country, though. But there's more. In a bold, yet honest move, I suppose, John List left a letter behind for the authorities to gain some insight into what he had done. The letter, which he addressed to his pastor, was both ice-cold and rather matter-of-fact about the crimes he had committed. John wrote that he was afraid for the future of his family, that his family were unaware of the fact that he had recently lost his job, and consumed by his failure, he had no desire for his family to face poverty and to live on welfare. He admits he could have just declared bankruptcy, but he says he can't imagine living with the shame which it would bring on his family. John also stated that he was afraid for the future of his children and believed they were turning away from God, especially his daughter Patricia, who was acting in a local community drama club and becoming more rebellious. And the most callous thing of all was the last line of the letter. It said, quote,
P.S. My mother is upstairs. She was just too heavy to move.
Now, from an entirely psychological perspective, this letter gave authorities a great insight into John's mindset at the time that he committed the murders. The religious elements to his notes revealed John's fall into paranoia and a distrustful mindset. The want or need to supposedly save his family was just a cover, albeit a cognitive one. With his daughter, we see the disappointed family annihilator, wanting to punish his family for not living up to his ideals and standards, the image of a perfect family. However, John List falls mostly into the anomic category, i.e. those who see their family as social symbols. When he lost his social status, his family just became accessories to a lifestyle that he no longer had. This becomes even more abundantly clear due to his behaviours in the years between the murders and his capture. The mood in Westfield becomes extremely tense. Neighbours and townsfolk don't know where List is, and there is fear that he could turn up back at the town and kill again. But he doesn't. For a while, police are overwhelmed with tips. There were people that swear that they saw him in Oregon, Chicago, the Florida Keys, and even in England, and police had to check each of them out. They even interviewed people who looked like him, confirming their identities through their fingerprints. But over the next 17 years, the case eventually goes cold. The search for John List turned up zero positive leads, and investigators were stumped. The case fell into the back of the public's minds, dooming it to remain on the cold case shelf. Could this have been the perfect crime, with John List getting away without any consequences? Well, by the early 1980s, John List has been missing for around a decade, and the case is now in the hands of a young detective named Jeff Hummel. Hummel can't find anything that the original investigators had missed, so he decides to seek the help of an unusual source. He meets with a psychic. As he has no leads whatsoever, Hummel decides to give the psychic a try, although appreciated that it was a long shot. The psychic says that she senses that John List is still alive and may be living in the southeast. That's not much of a lead for Hummel, however, but there's one thing she did tell him that was interesting. She said that List would be coming back to the gravesite of his family on his birthday. Hummel decides that he has nothing to lose. So on John List's next birthday, he stakes out the cemetery where his family are interred, Fairview Cemetery in Westfield, New Jersey. Their headstone inscription reads, quote, "There is peace in the Eternal Valley." Alma, John's mother, was buried in Michigan, where she was born, FYI. Hummel sat there, stalking out the grave throughout the day and night. He just hoped for the best. Then, just before midnight, Hummel is alerted to the sound of footsteps. But the footsteps belong to a group of college students taking a shortcut through the cemetery. Hummel is now officially out of leads. John Emil List has just disappeared. He's on the run. Then along came America's Most Wanted and Frank Bender. First airing in 1988 and hosted by John Walsh, who had himself dedicated his life to catching criminals after his own son was kidnapped, the show led to many people being brought to justice. During the show's 25 years on air, it broadcast episodes about thousands of known fugitives and led to the capture of more than 1,200 wanted men and women. In 1989, the show reached out to Frank Bender, a forensic artist who had worked with the US Marshals in the past on fugitive cases. And they asked him to produce an age progression image of John List for their upcoming segment on the murderer. while Bender had done age progressions before, helping catch two other fugitives. This would be the first case where he had so little to work with. The only photographs that Bender had available were grainy shots that only showed List's face, a far cry from the mug shots that he had worked with previously that showed the size of the perpetrator's head as well. But with the help of psychological profile for List generated by renowned psychologist Richard Walter, Bender was able to create an age progression of List and how he would look almost 20 years after he had murdered his family. At the same time, the FBI had created their own image using their computer software. But when they were informed that America's Most Wanted wanted to use Bender's creation as well, well, they refused to have theirs on the show. On May 21st, 1989, the episode aired on television across the United States, and investigators could do nothing but sit back and wait. But they didn't have to wait long. Of the more than 300 calls that were received from around the United States, one came from Wendy Flannery of Denver, Colorado. She stated that the image of List looked eerily like her old neighbor, Bob Clark, who, like List, was an accountant with a mastoidectomy scar behind his right ear. Clark was married to a woman named Dolores, and the couple had recently moved to Virginia. The FBI followed up the lead. Two agents from the FBI Fugitive Task Force go to Bob and Dolores' house. Dolores is home and invites them in. And as soon as they see the wedding photos on the mantle, they know they have the right guy. Dolores agreed the picture did look a lot like her husband, but he couldn't possibly be John List, a wanted fugitive. Later that same afternoon, while working at his accounting firm in Richmond, Bob Clark was arrested. While he adamantly denied that he was John List, the scar behind his right ear matched List's, as did his fingerprints. And after 17 years, 6 months, and 23 days, John List had been caught. This entire time, he had been hiding in plain sight. In 1990, after nearly 2 decades on the run, John List was extradited back to New Jersey to stand trial for murdering his family. It had been almost 20 years since he committed the murders, and he was finally apprehended. But where had he been all that time? Well, John List's escape was just as meticulous as his murders. So, when police discover List's Chevy Impala parked at JFK Airport in New York, a leading theory amongst law enforcement was that John List had fled to Germany. Besides the car at the airport, his passport was gone, he spoke German, and he had been there before. List's relatives told FBI agents that that would also be their guess, as he even had some distant relatives in the country. In fact, there is a documented report that an employee at the German consulate in New York said that a man matching List's description asked about a visa, saying that he was leaving for Germany soon, travelling alone, and he spoke German well. This was within days of the murders. But this didn't develop. Neither did List flee to Germany. There was also a theory that John List might have been the infamous hijacker D.B. Cooper. But that too wasn't true. He also wasn't a chicken farmer in South Jersey, as was rumoured amongst the locals in Westfield. Instead, John List had parked his car at the airport to throw police off his trail. He took buses and trains across the country on a non-direct route using fake names to buy the tickets until he ended up in his new home, Denver, Colorado. He said he wanted somewhere far enough away and briefly considered Phoenix, but it was too hot. He also said he considered San Francisco, but there were too many hippies there. List later told his prison psychiatrist that he thought he might want to see the mountains, so settled in Denver. How lovely. Like he had always been, he was meticulous in his planning and determined to stay one step ahead for his new persona as Robert Clark. He grew a mustache, bought a baseball hat and wore it low. He dressed way more casual than he ever had before. And List, or Robert Clark, now simply blends into the crowd. He has escaped with just $2,000, the last of his mother's savings, which he took after killing her. So he needs to get a job. And he does. But it's not in accounting. Instead, he works as a line cook at a Holiday Inn. Fun fact, Tim Seifert is the brother of Helen List, so essentially John List's brother-in-law. He stated that the whole family assumed that John List had fled overseas, likely Germany, as the police suspected. What Tim didn't know is that every year, when his family would take their annual two-week skiing trip to Colorado, they would stay at the same hotel that John List worked, the Holiday Inn. But they never once saw him, even though he was possibly in the very next room. Anyway, after a while, Bob Clark does start to let his guard down a little. He makes new friends, and he starts doing tax returns once again, eventually going back into full-time accounting. In 1976, he returns to church and even starts dating. A year later, he meets a tall 35-year-old divorcee at a singles event for Lutherans. The woman would become John's second wife, Dolores Miller. And after nearly 7 years of dating, he moves into her condo in Aurora in 1985. By 1987, after a few failed business ventures, John List is once again going broke. So he heads back across the country to Virginia to interview for accounting jobs. And he gets one, doing tax returns for a company in Richmond. His wife Dolores joins him there, where they purchase a new house and settle down. It's at this house that John would be arrested 18 years after committing his violent crimes. At his trial, John's defense was limited. You see, John had confessed to the murders in the letter that he left at the crime scene. So his attorney doesn't even try to argue that he's innocent. He stated during the trial, quote, "Let there be no mistake that my client, John E. List, killed his family." The defense argues that List should be convicted on a lesser charge, claiming his religious beliefs led him to believe that he had no choice but to kill his family to protect them from his financial problems. In John's mind, the defense argues, he felt like poverty was a sin, and he couldn't put his family in that position, so it would be better to send them to heaven. Dr. Stephen Simmering is brought in to conduct a psychological analysis of John List. He concludes that List is fully responsible for his actions. He was not a psychopath. He was not a sociopath. He was not a man without a conscience. He simply held a lifelong resentment of lack of success, and it overwhelmed him. In the end, List's insanity defense fails. Jurors convict him on the most serious charge, first-degree murder. Whilst there was no way to bring back the lives of those so brutally cut short that day in 1971, thanks to the efforts of the police, who never stopped hunting, an artist with amazing skills, and a television program, their killer was finally brought to justice. John List was convicted on 5 counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to 5 consecutive life sentences. He spent the remaining years of his life behind bars, passing away at St. Francis Medical Facility in Trenton, New Jersey, in March 2008, at the age of 82. Hey guys, one last message from me tonight. If you haven't already, please consider joining our Patreon over at www.patreon.com/deadsouls. It's just $2, and for that you get extra episodes, research articles, and will be supporting us and our work, which we can't thank you enough for. Hopefully I'll see you there. Good night, everyone.